in a group of texts called the Dharma Shastras. But I want to start with a hymn that's found in the 10th book of the Rig Veda, which is called the Purusha Sukta. Sukta just means su-ukta, that which is well said, which is generally translated as a hymn. And Purusha literally means person or man. And it's this passage describes how there is this Purusha, this being, this man, this person, who encompasses the whole world. He has 1,000 heads, 1,000 eyes, 1,000 arms, and he encompasses the whole world, and yet he exceeds the world. He's bigger than the world itself. And the essence, or the core part of this hymn describes how the gods sacrifice Purusha, and from that sacrifice comes everything we see in this world. Comes this the order we see in this world, and so you get the the Purusha, and you in Vedic ritual, if there's an animal involved, if it's an animal sacrifice, which some quite a few sacrifices are, what happens is the animal is strangled and then dismembered, and different things are done with the different sort of parts of the body. And so this hymn describes that you have this Purusha, who's basically the entire world plus a little bit more, and he is dismembered. And from the different parts of his body, the different elements of this world arise. And so it says, from his eye comes the sun, from his mind comes the moon, from his mouth, from his speech comes Agni, comes the god of fire. The different animals are born from this sacrifice. The Rig Veda, the Yajur Veda, the Sama Veda, the Atharva Veda are born from this sacrifice of the Purusha. And it's basically it's what it encapsulated quite nicely is this notion of this order of this world, this notion of this Rita, which not uncommonly in Vedic texts is meditated upon in terms of the order we find within the human body. Sort of there's a symmetry to the human body, and just as there's a symmetry to the human body and an order to the human body, so in the same way we find there's a symmetry and an order in the sort of the macrocosmos as well. And so you'll find often Vedic texts making links between various parts of the human body with various cosmic sort of things that are related, that have a correlation, like the eye and the sun, the mind and the moon, are very common correlations that are made. Now, there's one important sort of aspect of this hymn that comes in the very last verse, and one is it has to do with who is this Purusha, who is this being that encompasses the whole world and yet exceeds the world. And throughout the history of Hinduism, there's various traditions who comment on this. This becomes a very important hymn for the development of Hinduism. It's still recited in a lot of temples every day. But if you just look at the Rig Veda itself, at the very end, the Purusha is identified with Yajna itself, with sacrifice itself. And you get the phrase there where it says that it's the gods who sacrifice the sacrifice with the sacrifice. And so it goes back to that notion that you find the Vedic ritualists have, where the order of this world arises from sacrifice of the sacrifice in itself. So it's kind of the sacrifice is maintained, the order of the world is maintained by sacrifice. And so sacrifice, yajna, is the central concept in them. As we've seen in the Brahmanas, it becomes almost sort of a divinity of its own, as being the ultimate force, stronger even than the gods, in a cosmic significance. But there's one passage that's of this hymn that's particularly important for us now, and that describes how from this sacrifice comes the social order as well. And you get it says from the mouth of the Purusha come the Brahmanas, and you have all the names on the handout at the bottom of the first page. From the mouth come the brahmanas, who are the preservers of Vedic tradition, and the performers, the priests who perform the sacrifices. From his arms come the kshatriyas, who are the warriors and the kings and so on, who protect society and rule society. From his thighs come the vaishyas, who are farmers who tend cattle, as well as merchants. And from his feet come the shudras, which are the laborers. And you get this sort of idea that just as we find there's this order in the world, and we just as we have the sun and the moon and the different types of animals, so we have different types of different classes in human society. But as the hymn suggests, these orders of human society are as integral to the world, in a sense, and as old as the sun and the moon, which are described in the next verse as arising from the Purusha. Now, this notion that society is falls into those four classes, these are called the varnas, the literally classes of society, and each of those varnas, each of those classes has a corresponding duty that they have to perform in society. That is denoted by the notion of dharma. And dharma is a term that's very difficult to translate because it encompasses a wide range of concepts or a range of concepts that are expressed in different terms in English. Sometimes it's translated as religion, sometimes as duty, sometimes as ethics. And it's kind of a bit of all of them. And yet, you know, sort of none of them captures the notion of dharma itself quite well. But it's derived from the Sanskrit root dhri, which means to hold. And so it's the idea that this, the duties of those four classes, they hold the world together, they hold society together. If those four varnas act in an appropriate manner, according to their dharma, according to their duties, then the order of the world is maintained, the order of society is maintained, just as the performance of sacrifice maintains the cosmic order. And so it's kind of in we've seen the notion of ritta in Vedic texts. In later texts, the notion of ritta kind of becomes supplanted by the notion of dharma as the more important concept. And the word dharma is there in the Rig Veda and other Vedic texts, but becomes only sort of a key concept in later texts, and ritta kind of gradually disappears to the background. Now, the notion of these different varnas, these different classes, has everything to do with the importance of ritual, with the importance of yajna. All of this is centered around the performance of ritual, and it's sort of as we will see the ideas behind it, the sort of the presuppositions and the implications of this view all return back to the importance of yajna. And as we'll see later on when we look at different Hindu traditions, we'll see that there'll be very different views on these four varnas and the importance of those four varnas, because the worldview changes and because they have a different, they work from different presuppositions, and therefore the implications of this are differently assessed. The key texts in understanding this dharma are a group of texts called the Dharma Shastras, which literally means the shastras or the treatises on dharma. And they're a group of texts that are very diverse, actually. And you have on the handout, you have a table that you might recognize from last week's handout, because the beginning is the same as last week. So we saw that you have the four main Vedic collections, the Rig Sama Yajur and Atharva Veda, each with their own Brahmanas, their own supplements that elaborate on the importance of sacrifice, their own Aranyakas, which I don't remember if we said much about them last week, but they're essentially similar in nature to the Brahmanas. They're giving a separate status because they're said to deal with more esoteric interpretations of sacrifice, but essentially in terms of style and the way of that they think about sacrifice is very similar to the Brahmanas. So you can just sort of assume that they're sort of in a similar category for now. The Upanishads we'll talk about next week, but then you see there's three other categories below this. You have the Shravata Sutras, the Grihya Sutras, and the Dharma Sutras. And the Shravata Sutras, a sutra literally means a thread, and it's used to denote a text that's very concisely written. That's sort of a thread through the subject, sort of something that's easy to follow through the subject that it talks about. The Shravata and the Grihya Sutras, they're both ritual manuals. But basically, if you read the Rig Sama Yajur and Atharva Veda together with the Brahmanas, you have an understanding of the sort of rituals that are described in these texts and kind of that these texts tell you to perform, but they don't actually tell you step by step how to perform those rituals. And that you only get in the Shravata and the Grihya Sutras. And those are the ritual manuals that tell you, here's how you do this ritual, and step by step, these are the verses you recite, these are the actions that have to be performed, this is how the altars are built, and so on. The Shravata Sutras, Shravata is derived from the word Shruti. It's basically those that talk about the Shrutis. And the Shruti are the first four categories you have there, the Samhita, Brahmana, Aranyaka, and Upanishads. They're called the Shruti text. They're heard and they're transmitted orally from teacher to disciple, but they're also already in the Vedic texts themselves, are said, as we see in the Purusha Sukta, are said to be divine in origin. You know, they arise from the sacrifice of the Purusha. And so these texts are believed to be unauthored. They're not written by individuals. But they're eternal texts that are perceived by sages. And so these are called the Shruti texts. And so the Shruti Sutras deal with rituals that concern themselves, the Shruti Sutras talk about the main Vedic rituals, the most important Vedic rituals that are described in the Shruti text. The Grihya Sutras, Grihya means householder, sort of that which relates to the house, domestic. And so these deal with domestic rituals like the birth of a child, the marriage, funeral, and so on. But basically, these texts they're in a sense the core of Vedic ritual tradition because it's these texts that the ritualists actually follow and that they that tell them how to perform the sacrifice. Without these texts, you don't actually know how to perform a ritual. If the first four categories there are Shruti, these two texts and the last one as well, they're called Smriti, literally memory. And they're not believed to be of divine origins. They're written by individuals, by sages, and generally the names you have there for these texts are the names of the sages that are said to have composed these texts. So they're just, you know, you have the Kaushika Grihya Sutra is said to have been written by someone called Kaushika and so on. And so the idea is the relationship between these two. These Shruti texts are of non-human origin. They're unauthored. The Sanskrit term that's used for that is aparusheya. They don't come from a purusha, from a person, from a man. They're eternal texts, whereas the Smriti texts are authored, have a beginning in time. There's a time when these Shruti texts did not exist, and there's a time when they do exist, whereas this is not the case for the Shruti text. And they are but their authority is dependent on the Shruti text. And the standard analogy that is given is that you cannot remember something that you have not heard before. And so the Smriti text, they elaborate on the principles of the Shruti text and derive their authority only insofar as they actually teach what the Shruti texts teach. And so we'll see the concept of Smriti is much broader than the text we're looking at now, but this is kind of the origin of it very clearly, where you see these texts elaborate on the nature of Vedic ritual and basically tell you, okay, you've studied the Rig Veda, now here's how you perform this ritual step by step. Now, why is all this important for our understanding of Dharma and Dharma Shastras? Because you have this fourth category there, the Dharma Sutras. And the Dharma Sutras, you have there a bunch of texts. They're also related to one of the Vedic schools. So if you're taught in the Rig Veda, you would be taught the Vasishta Dharma Sutra. But it's also very clearly in these texts, you see, again, a very strong connection with the ritual concerns that you find in the Vedic and the Smriti texts, generally there in the Shat and Griha Sutras. Often these Dharma Sutras are seen to be sort of a part of a Shraddha Sutra and sort of just the continuation of that away from the performance of ritual itself to the implications of that for society and the way you deal with society. But also if you read these texts, they always assume that or the person that is addressed is always a Vedic ritual Brahmin. That's kind of the default position, and then it will kind of say, oh, well, if you're not a Vedic ritual Brahmin, then here's what you should do otherwise. And so these are the oldest Dharma Shastras, these Dharma Sutras. They're fairly brief. They're not very elaborate, but they deal essentially with the different stages of life that a person who follows the Vedic tradition goes through. And this is the flip side of the Varnashrama system, where it says you first you become a brahmachari, which is, and again you have those on the handout at the bottom there, which is a celibate student. You're supposed to become a brahmachari depending on your varna. The various ages are given, but generally sort of when you say when you're about 6-7 years old, you become a brahmachari. And the brahmachari approaches a guru, asks the guru to be taught the Veda, to be initiated into the study of the Veda, and then for the duration of that studenthood, the student does nothing but study the Veda. And study the Veda, you have to, if you remember from last week, the Vedas are oral texts, so the Veda is taught orally. It's a very rigorous practice that they undergo. They say it takes 12 years to actually memorize a Veda. And so you kind of end your studies by the time you're like 18, 19, 20 years old. And so your entire sort of childhood and youth, you're spent studying the Veda. There's a strong emphasis placed on celibacy. You're supposed to be celibate during this period and not have an interaction with women. Generally, brahmacharis, the Dharma Shastras are fairly clear on this, that brahmachari is only for male children. Women, we'll talk a bit more about women in a moment, but they don't fall into this. The way you're taught the Veda is essentially the guru sits there, recites a particular hymn, and you repeat it after the guru. And it goes back and forth until you've actually, and the guru will correct you when you do it wrong, until you've actually memorized it, and sort of it's kind of a constant repetition of these Vedic texts. If you have the handout from last week, it's probably easier to follow in there. I should have put it on here, but I forgot. But then the way they're, once they've memorized the Veda, the way they continue reciting this is very complex, and they've really developed an ingenious system that allows them to know these texts literally backwards and forwards. And they have what are called different pathas, or different recitation, different ways of reciting the text. And the first one is just you recite the text as you would find it in the printed sort of edition, just the main text, and as it would be recited during sacrifice. The second recitation is called the padapatha, the word recitation, where you recite each word individually, where you break up. In Sanskrit, you have sandhi rules, which change the word, the ending of a word, depending on what's the beginning of the next word, and so you dissolve those things. But then you get a series of recitations that become increasingly more complex. And it's basically, so if you have, so say these are the words of we have word A, B, C, D, and E, and so on, of a particular hymn. What they'll start doing is they'll start doing A, B, C, D, C, and they'll start going back and forth. So if you take the first verse of the Rig Veda, you have Agnim ide purohitam yagyasya devam. So you get Agnim ide ide Agnim ide Agnim ide Agnim ide Agnim ide Purohitam. And so, but then you get even more complicated. You get A B A B A B C C B, and then you get A B C C B A, B C D. Then you get A B C. Anyway, you kind of go through this backwards and forwards. So you get Agni Mide Ide Agnim Agni Mide Ide Purohitasya Purohitasya Ide Ide Purohitasya Purohitasya Yagyam Yagyam. And anyways, you go through the whole text like that, gradually backwards and forwards, until you really know the text literally backwards and forwards. And the emphasis is, the reason they place this emphasis on this is because during the ritual, during the ritual, you have to be able to pronounce the text at the right time in the right way. And so you really have to know the text inside and out in order to do that. But also because then, if you're a Brahmin, you have a responsibility to then teach it to the next generation. And so in order, as we all know, if I whisper something in your ear and you whisper it in their ear and so on, by the time it gets to the end of the room, sort of the message has been changed. And, as we all know, sort of the Chinese whispers sort of game that children play. And so they're very much aware of this. And in order to preserve the integrity of the text, they really drill themselves in memorizing this so they can pass it on to the next generation. And scholars of the Vedic tradition do claim that they've been able to do this in an exceptional way. Fritz Stahl, who is one of the main Vedic scholars, and who is not without his skepticism. But he famously said that, listening to Vedic Brahmins recite the text today is like listening to a recording that's a few thousand years old. It's that accurate in the way they do it. One of my own teachers had a friend who was a Yajurvedic Brahmin who memorized the Yajurveda, and he said, I can go to him and ask him what's word number 525 of the Yajurveda. And he says it'll take him a while, but he'll get it right. And he says that's how well they know the text. And they can just do it like that. And so that's why Brahmachari is stressed. It's you have to spend years and years and years and years memorizing these texts, internalizing this into your memory so that you then can pass it on to the next generation. It's a tradition that looks down on writing. We have sort of the idea that, I have to write this down before I forget, my brilliant idea that I have. For them, if you write it down, it's already lost, because then it's dependent on something external to you that, paper might perish. Whereas if you carry it in your memory, then you're able to transmit it and actually preserve it. Of the four varnas, only the top three are allowed to undergo brahmachari, or become a brahmachari, undergo brahmacharya. The shudras are not considered eligible for the study of the Veda. They're excluded from it. And these three are often therefore called dvijas, literally twice born, those who have been born dvij twice. They're born twice because the first time they're born, like anyone is born from the womb of their mother, the second time they're born through the initiation into Vedic ritual and the study of the Vedas. Once you've undergone this study of the Vedas, the Dharma Sutra say, then you go to the next phase, which is you become a grihastha, somebody who stays in a griha, in a house. You become a householder. I should say that in some of the earliest texts, we'll see there's four stages of life. The four stages are presented as as sort of alternatives that people can take. It's just here these four alternatives that you have to that you can take. Brahmachari is kind of seen as the foundation, but then the other three we'll see are seen as options. In the later Dharma Shastras, they're seen as really sort of stages, different stages. So you don't jump from brahmacharya to the third one, but you go through grihastha and so on. And if you're a grihastha, what it means is you've completed your Vedic study, and then you're expected to get married. Once you get married, you establish your own household. And the important part about establishing your own household is the establishing of Agni, the establishing of the god of fire into your household. And really, more than anything else, that signifies the establishing of a separate household. It doesn't always happen immediately after you get married, because people often would live with their extended family, with the parents and grandparents and so on, who would then have their own Agni already installed. So the worship continues with that. But the idea is that once Agni has been installed in your household, there's a ritual in which Agni is invoked and a fire is kindled. And as we've seen, Agni is the sort of the vehicle through which offerings are made. You make offerings into the fire, and Agni, the god of fire, carries that to the other gods. And for as long as you're alive, you have to keep that fire burning. If the fire goes out, you have to reinstall Agni and do the whole process again. It doesn't mean that you kind of have this big bonfire in your house, but it's generally kept in a pot with sort of glowing sort of embers that's then rekindled whenever a sacrifice is performed. When you're a grihastha, your obligation is to perform Vedic rituals. Brahmacharis cannot perform Vedic rituals because you have to be married in order to perform Vedic rituals. Your wife has some role to play in these rituals. And an unmarried man or a widowed man cannot perform Vedic rituals. The emphasis for the life of a grihastha, of a householder, is the responsibilities you have for society more broadly, where you act in accordance to whatever duties are associated with your varna. So if you're a Vaishya, your duties are agriculture and commerce and so on. If you're a Brahmin, your duty is the teaching of the Veda, performing rituals and so on. But also the emphasis is greatly on continuing your family lineages. There's a strong emphasis on getting children, particularly male children, who can continue the family lineage, because the female children, when they marry, they become part of the husband's family. Throughout the Dharma Shastras, you see this constant emphasis on the importance of children, of continuing family lineages, which you also find in Vedic texts as well. One of the common benedictions that's sort of asked of the gods is cows and horses, because it's an agricultural society, so this represents wealth, and sons, heroic sons, often it's said, as being a great gift of the gods, because It allows you to repay the debt that we talked about last week to your ancestors who have given you life, and it, so it's your duty to continue the family lineage. But also, as we've seen last week, because if you die and you attain heaven, you become like one of the gods, and therefore offerings have to be made to you as well, which can only be made by your ancestors, by your descendants, who make offerings to their ancestors. And so your children will continue making offerings to you and your ancestors. And so there's a strong emphasis on that as well. And it's really most of the Dharma Shastras have to do with this stage of life, with the life of a grihastha, the life of a householder. And most of the, particularly the Dharma Sutras, these earliest texts, deal with various situations that might arise. They tell you these are the duties, sort of in general, of grihasthas of the four varnas. But then also they talk about, well, what happens if, you know, how should these four relate to each other? How should a Brahmin interact with a Vaishya or a Shudra, and so on? How should, you know, if a Brahmin comes to your house, how should you treat them? If, you know, you interact with a Shudra, how should you treat them? And so on. A lot of the Dharma Shastras are really about what is called prayaschitta, or atonements. If you violate dharma in some way, if you do something that goes against dharma, how can you atone for that transgression? What do you have to do in order to regain your purity, which comes from following dharma? And so a lot of the Dharma Shastras have to do with this, and you get these long lists of you know, if you do this wrong, then these are the atonements you can perform. The most grievous sin that's always talked about is the killing of a Brahmin. So if you kill a Brahmin, whether accidentally or intentionally, there's very heavy atonements that are penances that are prescribed for that. Next on the list is adultery. The Dharma Shastras are very, very, very heavy on adultery. It sort of shocks a lot of people when they read this. And there's various sort of prayaschittas given depending on what sort of adultery you've performed with what kind of a person in relation to you. And, you know, if a Brahmin commits adultery with a Vaishya, there's different rules that apply than if it's with a Kshatriya or another Brahmin and so on. Generally, if there's a senior, if you're in a higher position and there's adultery with someone in a lower position, some of the penances for those are really intense. One of the most intense ones is a man has to cut off his own genitals, hold them in the cup of his hands, and walk towards the east until he drops dead. And that clears him of the sin of committing adultery. So it's heavy stuff. And the reason I mention this is because Manu is also very, Dharma Shastra in general, is very heavy also on women. And there's a lot of emphasis, as we'll see in a moment, on women being chaste to their husband. And people kind of generally focus on that part and kind of ignore what he has to say on men who commit adultery. In general, Dharma Shastras doesn't prescribe atonement for women. And women don't have to undergo any atonement if they do something wrong. But it's their monthly period is seen to be sort of purifying themselves. And so Dharma Shastra always says women just have to wait and then they will be pure again. And so there's no atonement for them. But for men, some of the atonements are very intense. But the reason why there's such emphasis given on chastity is because of this whole concern. It's all about this yajna, about this ritual. And you get these discussions in Dharma Shastra that what if I raise a son who's not my biological son, and if I die and I go to heaven, I think I've raised children, I've raised sons who are my own, so they will continue my family lineage, they will continue making offerings to the ancestors. But what if that son is not actually my son, but it's my neighbor's son, who had an affair with my wife? And the Dharmashastras disagree on what happens then. Some argue that the offerings the child will make, or the grown man by that time will make, will go to the biological father, because that's sort of the biological sort of connections are more important. Some argue no, it goes to whoever raised the child unknowingly, not knowing that it was somebody else's child. But it also comes into the issues of adoption. There's various ways in which you can adopt, but adoption is not kind of just saying, okay, you're now my child. There's rituals that have to be performed to make that child your own child and so on. And so that's kind of why there's such emphasis on this, because it has sort of these sacrificial concern that lie at the root of this, that they start from, these are the presuppositions that they start from, which then translates into the way they look at the rest of society. That said, the Dharmashastras are not black and white in any of this. And the Dharmashastras themselves are very emphatic on the fact that you cannot, if a transgression is made, or even if, you know, a Brahmin comes to your house, how should you welcome the Brahmin and so on. The Dharmashastras themselves emphasize that this is not just answered by reading the text and by saying, okay, this is what it says, therefore this is what I should do. It has always had, the text has always to be interpreted by the local community in which you live, by the Brahmins who are part of that community, who are the guardians of Dharma, and they will apply Dharmashastra in whatever way they see fit. To the extent that if the local community says, we don't care about this part of Dharmashastra, that is Dharma, because they're the guardians of Dharma, and so their word is final in this. There's a famous verse that's found in some of the Dharmashastras where it says that if you're in doubt what to do, and this is kind of addressing Brahmins, if you're in doubt what to do, what is dharmic and what is not dharmic, they say, look at the Dharmashastras and see the ideas that are given there. If there's a variety of opinions given there, which is often the case. Most of the Dharmashastras say, you can do this, or you can do this, or you can do this. And some say you can do this, and they rarely resolve this and just say, these are the various things that people do. Pick whatever you like. Which kind of ties into the question of, you know, are these texts prescriptive or descriptive? Do they merely prescribe the customs of the society in which they live, which they often do, but there's also sort of an element that is prescriptive, where they say, this is how you should do it. And so it's kind of, they sort of oscillate between those two approaches. And so this verse says, if you're in doubt about Dharma, look at the Dharmashastras. If the Dharmashastras are sort of ambiguous about what it is, then go to the local Brahmins. If the Brahmins give you different opinions, as they will often do, it says then you go with whatever you think is right. If one Brahmin tells you, well, this is what you should do, the other says this is what you should do, and you have no way to resolve it, then they say just go with whatever feels right to do at that point, and that will be following Dharma. So they're not so black and white in the application of it, which is important to emphasize, because what happened with the Dharmashastras in the 19th century is when the British ruled India, they used religious law for personal law, so for marriage and so on. Religious law would apply, and so for Islam that would be Sharia would be used, whereas for Hindus a Dharmashastra became used, and so Dharmashastra sort of becomes used as sort of law books governing the way, you know, sort of inheritance and marriage and so on are dealt with, which are both big topics in Dharmashastra, and kind of in a sense using these texts then become used in a way that these texts themselves say they should not be used, where, you know, they always emphasize the importance of the community in which you live in adjudicating dharma. So the Grihastha stage, the emphasis there really, when you're in the householder life, the emphasis is always on community. You have no identity separate from community. The Dharmashastras do not, and Vedic ritual more broadly, they do not think as the person as an individual, but always as someone whose identity is determined by the community in which they live. You're not just a person, but you're a Brahmin because you're born in a Brahmin family, or a Vaishya because you're born in a Vaishya family. You're part of a particular family lineage. You're a husband, a wife, with children, with responsibilities towards that. And there's this very emphatic emphasis on acting in accordance with that. The Dharmashastras, at least the early Dharmashastras, really look down on ascetics, as we'll see. Basically, the Dharmashastras say ascetics are selfish people and are asuras, or demons, or at least the idea of asceticism, of living a renounced life, a celibate life, as a sadhu, that's something that the asuras came up with. You have a passage on the handout about this. And the idea of that is because even though this is sort of seen as the fourth order, sannyasa, or ascetic life, and later Dharmashastras are not so, just have incorporated it, but the early Dharmashastras are looking down on this. And the idea is that if you become an ascetic, you cut your ties with society and with your community and with your family, which means also with your wife, if you were married in the first place, which means you cannot perform yajna, you cannot perform Vedic rituals. If you cannot perform Vedic rituals, you cannot sustain the order of the world. If you cannot sustain the order of the world, the asuras gain the upper hand over the devas, over the gods. Therefore, the asuras must have come up with the idea of asceticism. That's sort of the logic of it. And so they really look down, at least the early Dharmashastras. Later Dharmashastras have incorporated and is just sort of the final stage of it. But it's kind of, you see this sort of a real distinction between the individual of the ascetic and the communal ties of the Dharmashastras. Of course, the ascetics, as we'll see, have their own kind of communities and so on, and they're not these lone individuals that have no contact with anyone. But that's sort of another issue. It's kind of more sort of the ideology of the two that is sort of at odds with each other. The third stage that is talked about in Dharmashastra is Vanaprastha. And it's the living in the forest. It's a stage of life where you live a somewhat ascetic life, but you're still married and you still perform Vedic ritual, but you live away from society in the forest, in a remote place. We see in some of the earlier texts there's descriptions of people who from Brahmachari go straight into Vanaprastha and just live in a more ascetic life, but a ritual life, performing rituals in the forest. Whereas later on it sort of becomes seen that you start your life as a Brahmachari, you get married, you gradually sort of retire from your active life in society. You're still married, you still perform rituals, but you retire to sort of a more ascetic life, and then ultimately, if you're a man, you become a sannyasi and you renounce the world. That's sort of the way it becomes to be seen in the later Dharmashastras. The Dharma Sutras the Dharmashastras write about these four stages, with sannyasa sort of having a somewhat ambiguous state in the earlier text. But they generally write of these four in relation to the dvijas, the twice born, and then particularly the Brahmins. That's sort of the default position that they're describing. Shudras have no ashrama. These are called the ashramas. Shudras don't really have an ashrama. They're not allowed to study the Veda. They get married, obviously, but they don't perform Vedic rituals because they're not allowed to study the Veda, so they can't recite the Veda and so on. So they don't have sort of the same division into those four. But the upper three classes, the twice born, they have the stages are the same for all of them, but even there's differences for all of them. So a Brahmin grihastha is not the same as a Vaishya grihastha, for example. There's different duties that come with them and different sort of things that are allowed for them. A Brahmin, for example, is never allowed to drink alcohol. And the Dharma Shastras are very, very clear on that. Alcohol is polluting for a Brahmin. A Kshatriya can drink alcohol and there's no problem with that. And so you kind of get sort of different sort of codes that govern these different people. And so the idea is kind of, I suppose most people today sort of look at this and sort of find the idea that, you know, sort of enshrined in our modern worldview is that, you know, everyone is born equal. We're all sort of the same, whether it's kind of in sort of potential or in to the law and so on, we're all the same. Dharma Shastra is like, no, not everyone is the same. We're all humans, yes. But it's kind of, I suppose, as William Blake says, one law for the lion and the ox is oppression. And that's kind of the idea of the Dharma Shastras. If you have the same law that applies to a lion as an ox, that would be oppression for both because they're such different animals that not the same rules can apply to them. You'll find a lot of contemporary Hindus arguing that the idea of these four varnas is not determined by birth, but by actions. So whatever you're born into, whatever family you're born into, doesn't determine your varna. That's a view that is a very modern view, and that would not have worked very well in an agricultural society where, you know, we sort of have to, we undergo this because, you know, my father's a carpenter, his father was a theologian, and so you kind of have this sort of breaking of the varnas, if you think in sort of those terms there. And this is possible because, you know, in our society you spend years of your whole childhood and youth in school where you're kind of having the option of choosing what you're going to do with your life in many cases, not in all cases if you're of a financially more difficult sort of situation, you're often just forced into work much earlier. Whereas here, particularly with the upper classes, you start your brahmachari when you're a child, which means by the time you're a young adult, you're fully trained in the profession of your parents. You become an economic sort of necessity for them. You know, it's good to have children because they allow you to bring money in, essentially. And so you're trained from a very early age. And so you do find some verses in Dharma Shastra, but not in the main Dharma Shastras, that say that if we see the qualities of a Brahmin in someone who's born as a Shudra, that person should be considered a Brahmin. But these are rare, and these are kind of more treated as the exceptions rather than the rule in these things. Dharma Shastras are very clear that dharma is your varna is determined by birth, in most cases in sort of normal sort of state of affairs, now briefly, where do women fit into this? Women have a particular varna, so you have Brahmin women and Kshatriya women and Vaishya and Shudra women, and their varna is very important to them. Particularly for rules of marriage, who you can marry, but also for the way you interact with society at large. The idea of the interaction in general is that the higher you are in the hierarchy, the purer you are. And the purer you are, which is important for the performance of a ritual, which is dependent on purity. And so the more you will restrict your interactions with members of lower classes. Women have their own varna, I mean have a varna, one of those four, and that's important for those rules of purity and for marriage and so on. But they don't have ashramas. And the dharma for women, irrespective of their ashram, of their varna, is the same. And basically, just as you have a brahmana dharma and a kshatriya dharma, the dharma shastras talk about as three dharma, or the dharma of women. And it's essentially the way Manu puts it. The Manu Smriti is one of the most influential later dharma shastra texts. Says for a woman, a woman doesn't have brahmacharya and grihastha and vanaprastha and sannyas and so on. But for a woman, what is the initiation ceremony that takes place for a male child who gets initiated in the study of the Veda is the marriage ceremony. And so the idea is that women, their identity is determined by their marriage. They marry a particular man, and then they assist that man in the performance of ritual and so on. Most Dharma Shastras say that, all Dharma Shastras say, that women cannot perform any rituals independent of their husband, and whatever ritual practices they perform, they have to do it in support of their husband. And there's also a strong emphasis given on dependence on other men. Women are not given independence in the sense that when they're children, they're dependent on their elder male relatives, their father and so on. If they're married, they're dependent on their husband. If they're widows, then they are dependent on their male children, their elder and so on. And so their responsibility is kind of geared towards the family, the household affairs and so on. That's how it is presented. That said, if you look at Vedic texts themselves, it seems that was not always the case. We have a list of, there's a number of female Vedic sages that are associated with specific Vedic hymns, which indicates that women did study the Veda at some point and were involved in that life more actively. But definitely by the time of the Dharma Sutras and certainly by the time of the later Dharma Shastras, that is kind of over. That's no longer sort of seen to be a case, and their roles are sort of limited to household affairs. And these women are not allowed to remarry, according to Dharma Shastra. If the husband dies, a wife is not allowed, or a widow is not allowed to remarry, but has to remain sort of single, living under her sons for the rest of her life. And that's kind of, whereas men are allowed to remarry. Men are allowed to remarry because without without a wife, you cannot perform Vedic rituals. So they're allowed to continue to marry someone else to continue the Vedic rituals, whereas women cannot perform rituals independently. So that's sort of not part of the picture. That said, again, with Dharma Shastra, you kind of always have to... There are sort of two sides to Dharma Shastra. One is sort of the explicit ideals that they sort of portray. And one is kind of, if you read between the lines, you see that practice was often different. And for example, with the remarrying, for example, the Dharma Shastras are very clear, women cannot remarry, and this is sort of stated again and again and again. But then when you go to sort of, you skip a couple of chapters in these texts, and you go to the section that deals with inheritance, which is a huge topic in Dharma Shastra. You get, for example, discussions on, say, I die, what do the children of my wife that are not my own children, what do they get? Which kind of, if you sort of, you realize, oh, they're talking here about me having remarried, or sort of having married a woman who had children from a previous marriage. And so, you know, so it's kind of saying, okay, the ideal is don't remarry. The practice is we do see people remarrying. So what do we do in such a situation when issues of inheritance come up? The Dharma Shastras are also very very different views on when it comes to inheritance for women. Can women inherit? What do women inherit? Some are kind of almost righty, the women out of it, and it goes mostly to the sons. Some say, no, the women does have a share in the inheritance as well. And so it's kind of, you do get very different views on those things, which goes back to the point that, you know, they're not sort of law books, they're books that sort of are guidelines for the local community to then judge on how this is going to be interpreted and applied. So that's kind of the sort of social implications of Vedic ritual. That's sort of how it translates into social concerns. As we will see when we look at other texts, this is the backdrop to what a lot of other texts have to say. We'll see that a lot of the other texts question the presuppositions of this and say, well, why are these issues of purity so important? Why is there such emphasis on ritual? Why are women given this position, and so on? But this is kind of the way sort of mainstream society was shaped, to which then other traditions and so on respond against and have very different views on them. Next week we'll move to the Upanishads, which are also considered Shruti. They're part of the Vedic revelation, but they move into a very different direction.